Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Chicago's Morning Answer on 560, The Answer. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser filling in today for Dan and Amy. We're so glad that you could join us. I want to tell you first up front here, Joe and I usually spend our days working at the Illinois Policy Institute. We're thrilled to be able to join you this morning, where the views and opinions expressed by the host of this program will be those of themselves alone, not necessarily representing those of the Illinois Policy Institute or Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
There are opinions, they should be yours. So we'll work on that over the course of the program today. Get really excited to be with you. I think mostly recovered from Christmas, Joe. How was your Christmas?
It was pretty good. Pretty relaxing. It's nice to have a few days off around now. Got the new iPhone 10, which is freaking me out because I was on an iPhone 6 before then. I haven't charged this phone, and I got it a couple days ago. I haven't charged it in weeks though. It's incredible. How about yours?
It was good. I would ask you first, though, have you set it to read your face yet?
I did, and it's freaking me out.
Yeah,
so, I'm just kind of accepting that Apple has all my information and kind of owns my life now, so it's whatever. Once you get over that initial hump of being worried about it taking your facial recognition, it's actually okay.
It is the brave new world.
Yeah.
Good. I mean, I'm always thrilled to hear when people had a relaxing holiday. That's nice. Yeah. It's a nice thought. I have children. Well, I mean, you're familiar with the concept,
I imagine. Yeah, and it's not one that I embrace.
I have children, and which always means that it's the holidays are, especially Christmas, is more stressful because there is so much that you have to do to prepare for the Christmas holiday. I have been hearing, especially from my daughter, what she wanted for Christmas starting roughly back in January. And it's hard to keep track of every single thing. I mean, short of just saying the entirety of the American Girl catalog, it's hard to keep track of exactly every single thing that she is asking for.
Did you take your kids to see one of those mall Santas where they... read off their Christmas list.
Did we? Oh, God,
that's something
it's a blur.
I did as a child.
Yeah, I did it all the time as well, and I'm pretty sure that we did. Oh yeah, we did because we were members of the Museum of Science and Industry, and they have a member breakfast where Santa is.
I'm not sure why I ever did that because I always knew, even when I still believed in Santa Claus as a young child, I knew that the mall Santa wasn't the real Santa. So I'm not. It's an odd tradition, but anyway.
Yeah,
I
always read it as he's a surrogate. You know, he's a representative.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that, like, you know, priests are the representative here on Earth of Christ. You know, he's a representative. Santa's a representative. Yeah,
that's a good analogy.
Yeah, especially hey, it's Christmas, right? So yeah, I'm glad to hear you had a nice, relaxing Christmas. Let me tell you about mine.
Go for it.
Christmas Eve, right? Christmas Eve. Already having some fun. We had gone on the architectural open house tour back in, I believe it was October, and one of the stops we made was at Holy Name Cathedral, which if you've never been to Holy Name Cathedral in Chicago, it's impressive.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have some friends who are critics of the architecture that think it's a mishmash of styles, but nonetheless, the production is rather impressive there. And I thought, okay, all right, this would be cool. We should go here for a Christmas Eve service. What I didn't think was just how early we would need to get there. So we got there at about 3:45. And there was already a group gathering in the back of the church because there were no seats left.
For a 4 o'clock mass?
For a 4 o'clock Christmas vigil mass. And thought, well, we could do one of two things. We could either stand throughout the mass, which again, I have kids ages 8 and 5, or we can get back in the car. We can bust it down to the south side, Hyde Park area where I live, and try to make mass at our home parish. We went with the latter option.
And this is also a 4 o'clock?
This is also a 4 o'clock mass. So because it could possibly be held against me, I will not go to exactly how fast I went down Lakeshore Drive. But needless to say, faster than I think you're supposed to, if not only because Lakeshore's speed limit is stupid. And if you actually were to go the speed limit on Lakeshore Drive, it would be dangerous because no one else does.
Yeah, it's a suggestion.
It truly is a suggestion. So we were going a little faster than normal, though, and made it only 10 minutes past 4 p.m. So I'm thinking, okay, all right, we recovered fairly well from this. This is going well. And then I remembered one of the traditions that my wife and I have is that we always get sushi for dinner on Christmas Eve. And I had the brilliant idea of using these delivery.com points that I could get, like, you know, my entire dinner for like $7 because I had so many of them stacked up. And I had ordered it to be picked up at a place only like 5 minutes away from Holy Name. I'm like, oh, man. So now we got in the car afterwards. I had to drive back up to downtown, pick up dinner, drive back home.
Are the kids still with you?
Kids are still with us at this point. Kids are still with us. Having a jolly old time. Actually, they were fairly well behaved, all things considered. That's good. Outside of the normal wrestling I have to do with my son, who very loudly throughout the mass will ask, is it time to go yet? He's been pretty good, all things considered, and they're doing well with this, all things considered.
Okay. It's still early in the evening, though.
It is. I only realize once we get back home, we get the kids fed and we get them kind of like, you know, they start to open their one Christmas Eve present. I don't know if this is a tradition your family enjoyed as well. I realize that I ordered the sushi incorrectly, and instead of having, like, you know, the regular rolls, I have hand rolls, which, one, I didn't know that was an option. I thought I was just clicking the button I had to click, and no, I was not. I ordered that incorrectly, which frustrated me. So yeah, Christmas Eve was great. Truly relaxing. And I haven't even gotten to Christmas Day yet.
Do your kids, 5 and 8, already enjoy sushi?
No, they would not eat it. They would not even come close to eating it. They're not that adventurous. Not even close.
Wasn't sure if they had a refined palate,
but yes, I haven't even gotten to Christmas morning yet.
Okay.
Christmas morning is this joyous period of time, right, where all the kids like get to open presents and everybody's having fun. I want to tell you about the fun that we had and how exactly it started. We will do it after this break. We want you to be a part of the program with us today. You can call us at 312-642-5600. You can share your fun Christmas experiences. If you think you have a story that tops my Christmas experience, I certainly want to hear about that. You can text us, text DA to 64636 if you want to be a part of the program. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy, talking about our separate Christmas experiences. And I'd led up only to Christmas morning for the Christmas that I had. I want to continue that story now. So my children are early risers.
Which makes you, I'm sure, an early riser.
By necessity, an early riser. I want to stress, they got this from my wife's side of the family, not from mine. I appreciate that they have this gene, assuming that it is one that they will continue throughout their lives. I wish I was the kind of person who could get up naturally early in the morning.
Oh, I agree. You're much more productive.
I'm just not. Waking up at like, you know, 3:30 or whatever, 3:15 that I did this morning for this program to be with you all here today. It's not something that I'm used to.
I didn't really know there was a 5:30 in the morning, 5:25 in the morning. I've heard of it.
I understood it in the academic sense, you know, in the way that I've never been to Paris, but I know a thing called Paris exists. Kind of the same with that, right? You know, 3:30 in the morning. Although enough to remember in college when it was like I experienced 3:30 in the morning when I was still up at 3:30 in the morning.
But that's
qualitatively different
than
waking up at 3:30 in the morning out of necessity. So, yes, my kids are early risers. My son will be up sometime around 4:30 to 5 every single morning. My daughter, who's 8, is starting to sleep a little bit later. Thank the Lord. So that's what they're normally up. So the like one day of the year where this actually kind of dovetails into what normal parents experience is Christmas, where kids supposedly all get up remarkably early because they want to open presents. It's really not all that much earlier than our children normally wake up. So one day out of the year, it works out fine. What we decided to do was we knew they would get up between 4:30, 5, something like that. My wife and I are not ready to do anything at that time of the morning. So we let them open their stockings and then let them play for a while before we would get up and open presents with them a little bit later. This is going fine. They're dealing well with this.
So you get up at like 4:30, you kind of like let them out like a dog.
Do the walk, the bathroom thing. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's stocking opening. They open their stockings. They start to play with some of the stuff that they got. They also have their tablets that they can watch. We put a Christmas program on for them. And about 6 a.m., my wife and I have kind of fallen back asleep. And my son knocks one of the stockings, one of mom and dad's stockings that are not open, off of the mantle. It makes a loud noise. And normally that would not, I don't think, be enough to like really wake us up. Except we have a security system in our house that you can set, you know, a higher level of security when you're away. And a lower level of security, so like if someone tries to break down the door for when you're there overnight, and it's still set. And one of the things it's sensitive to is loud noises. So we were both awakened by the screaming of our house alarm from my son knocking the stocking off of the mantle, which in the pantheon of ways to wake up in the morning, a screaming siren is not one of them. It's like, I'm sure if you go through the iPhone settings that you have, because it's on, you know, even my older version of the iPhone, there's the option for like the submarine alarm.
Oh, yeah, it's terrifying.
Who would wake up to that?
One of my roommates in college had that, and now anytime I hear that, I freak out. It's a PTS situation.
Yes, so this is the way that I started my Christmas morning. But the good news is, thanks to a podcast I was listening to and a great idea from one of the hosts of this program, I think I discovered the perfect way to not only cope with this kind of, I don't even know quite how to describe it, this incredibly fuzzy feeling that you have from being shocked awake, as one might be from a screaming siren at 6 in the morning. I think I found the perfect way to deal with it.
And
you're going to have to come back after the break.
Oh, it's always teasing.
to find out the perfect possible way to deal with, well, a screaming siren and children at 6 in the morning after they've been up since 4:30. I tell you, it works.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy. We've been talking about our Christmas experiences, and want to finish sharing with you the way that I found to deal with the joy of not only being first woken up by excited children at 4:30 in the morning, but then again being woken up by my son setting off the house security system and 2 minutes of a screaming siren to begin my Christmas morning. I've been listening to a podcast with Charles C.W. Cook from National Review, who shared a Christmas tradition that he had. He grew up just outside of Cambridge in England. That part of their Christmas tradition is, well, the kids will open the stockings first and the gifts from Father Christmas, which he says is also enjoyable because Father Christmas will always, you know, get them a few things that they want, but he's also the one that gets them the things that they need. The, you know, quintessential socks and underwear gifts that you didn't appreciate as a child. But it's also the kind of gifts that, like, you know, the older you get, the more you come to appreciate it, because it means I don't have to go out and buy those things myself.
Yeah, that's how I know,
which is not something I'm at all jazzed about doing. So it becomes something you appreciate later in life. But at the, you know, the 5-year-old, 8-year-old point, not so much.
And my goal is to have 365 pairs of underwear. That's what I only have to do a load of laundry once a year. So that's the kind of gift I really appreciate.
If you can get like the 365 pairs, then you just like, you can just throw them out after each one you wear.
And then, yeah, get new Christmas. Yeah.
And new Christmas, yeah. And you just start the whole process over again. So Charles said that what he learned is, especially as he grew up, the way that his parents always helped cope with all of the insanity of Christmas morning is you brew a pot of coffee. And in addition to that, you open a bottle of champagne.
Okay.
It works. Let me tell you. It works.
By what do you define works?
It kind of brought me down from the nervous high of having my security system scream at me to start Christmas morning.
That's interesting how alcohol does that. You know, that's. I'm glad that could help you out on your Christmas morning and dealing with your kids and the alarm and all that. It's funny. You asked me about my Christmas, but that reminds me, you know, sometimes I have champagne in the morning, not before work, but on the weekend sometimes. And actually on Sunday, the 23rd, I had champagne in the morning, polished off a box of Entenmann's donuts. And the reason I did was because I didn't have
Breakfast
kids.
Of champions. Yeah.
Because I didn't have kids.
Yeah.
And because I could.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you got to experience that too.
No, I think you underestimate the experience of being a parent. So like when somebody, like my doctor, when he asks, you know, hey, you know, like he always asks those questions about how much, you know, how many drinks do you have a week?
You have to lie.
Do you ever drink alone? And my answer is always like, no, the kids are usually running around somewhere. it was a fun way, enjoyable way to start the morning. I enjoy a nice bottle of champagne as much as the next pseudo elitist that I sound like saying I enjoy champagne in the morning. But nonetheless, yeah, rather fun, rather enjoyable. Had a good time.
I'm glad you had a nice Christmas.
Thank you.
Yeah. The story only took 40 minutes.
Yeah. Well,
but it had a happy ending.
it had a very happy ending. Thank you. I hope someday you can also appreciate that joy of being woken up by a small screaming version of yourself at 4:30 in the morning. I will say one of the things about having children that I have come to appreciate is I have come to appreciate the plight of everyone I know. And I'll tell you why. Because I didn't realize quite how obnoxious I could be until I had small versions of myself and had to argue with them.
You probably, your respect for your parents grows
through the
immensely.
Roof.
Yeah.
Yeah. Through the roof.
Yeah.
But also it's, you know, you're not perfectly replicants of your parents. But, you know, you see enough of yourself in there. And for me, like, one of the hardest things to grapple with is the idea that my children are not tiny adults and that I can't reason with them.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
No. Yeah. Yeah. I've always kind of looked at, well, not always, but more recently in my jaded 20s, is
jaded 20s.
Kids are kind of just like dumb people. They're just not. They don't have the sense of reasoning. They don't have the sense of logic.
They're like drunk young adults.
Yes. Yeah. That works.
Yeah. They are. If you've ever had to deal with a, you know, young adult, maybe college age, just out of college age friend who has had too much to drink, who is irrational, who will demand food on a moment's notice, who will get bizarrely picky about the who will think of combining foods that should not be combined. Let me give you an example. If I ask my 5-year-old what he will want for dinner, I will typically get an answer of something like a hot dog and yogurt.
And what's the problem?
Those
are a couple of my favorite things.
Or as you call this, Thursday. not typically things that I would think to pair together. Not that he consumes them simultaneously.
He doesn't like cut the hot dog up and then dip it in the
dip
yogurt.
It in, no. Okay. You know, he might have at one point in time. I'm now kind of struggling to remember if that was a thing that happened. It probably has. But the idea of pairing to me a hot dog and heavy dairy does not naturally speak to me.
Yeah. I say tomato, you say tomato.
Yeah, right. So that it is kind of like dealing with that, you know, a drunk young adult, or at least in my limited experience. That's kind of what it's been like. If your experience has been different, if your experience varies, please call me and tell me, especially if you have older kids. I want to know. You can see, too, as they develop personalities, like my daughter, the frustrated affectation that she wears on occasion is just going to wear beautifully on like a 15-year-old. It's going to be delightful. I can already
And that'll
tell.
Be here before you know it.
I'm already halfway there.
Yeah,
she's 8. I'm already almost halfway, more than halfway there. So that's going to be exciting. I'm looking forward to that experience and her. But the great part about it is right now she's more or less incapable of being embarrassed by me, because she has no true context for that social experience of what it's like to feel embarrassed by your parents. Oh, but it's coming.
Oh, it definitely comes. That's probably around, I don't know, 12,
13. I think once you hit the teens, I tend to think.
And probably lastly about 17, 18, 19.
We'll come back to this after the break, but there's an interesting tweet that I saw because, Joe, you'd referenced you got an iPhone for Christmas. I want to come back to that. But and to the way things change, but as shopping malls have kind of gone away, like, to me, the quintessential idea of embarrassing your children is like dropping them off or picking them up from a shopping mall. But as shopping malls disappear, what is it going to look like? What is my embarrassing my children experience going to look like? I don't know yet. But we'll come back to this idea of how quickly things have changed, how different it is now, what it is like living now than it was even just 15 years ago. Share your Christmas stories with us at 312-642-5600, or you can text DA to 64636. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy.
This is the morning show more Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser filling in today for Dan and Amy. Be part of the program, 312-642-5600 to give us a call, or you can text DA to 64636. The last segment we had, I'd mentioned the iPhone, Joe, you said you got for Christmas. It's a lovely gift.
10, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lovely gift. There's this tweet going around on this website called Twitter.com. Things that didn't exist 15 years ago. I'm going to give you this list. Okay. 15 years ago.
So this is 2003?
I was told there would be no math.
Somewhere around there.
That sounds about right. The iPhone, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter.com, the very website from which I'm reading this. That's Meta.
Yeah.
Instagram, the iPad, Netflix streaming, Google Maps, Snapchat, Spotify, the Android, Uber, Lyft, Alexa, Airbnb, the App Store, Google Chrome, WhatsApp, Fitbit, Waze, Slack, Square, Dropbox, Pinterest, Venmo, Bitcoin, Hulu, and Kindle. None of these things existed. I haven't fact-checked this. I assume that's true, but
it sounds true. I don't remember the first year the iPhone came out, but yeah, everything else is within the last
iPhone would
eight,
have been
years.
2006, I believe.
Okay.
2006, 2007.
Sure. And then everything else, Twitter, mid to late thousands, Bitcoin, somewhere around 2010, I want to say. Someone can fact check me on that. But
For the most part,
it's last between 7 to 10 years.
Yeah. 15 years ago, we didn't have any of these things. So the question, I think it raises, is are we better off for having these things? Now, I bemoaned, not truly bemoaned, a minute ago, the loss of the shopping mall as truly this kind of gathering place. Like, it was a place that I went with my friends in high school and junior high to hang out.
Same.
Bookstores is another one. I used to get into it with this friend of mine about how we're losing bookstores as this place of an exchange of ideas, of a sense of some kind of community around literature and ideas that exists in the notion of a bookstore. That we're losing this because Amazon is driving them out of business. Oh, and by the way, we're actually not. I saw a report a couple days ago that like small mom and pop type bookstores are actually growing. More people are reading physical books now than they did 3 years ago, 4 years ago. So despite the iPad, the Kindle, all of these devices on which you can do digital reading, physical books are still popular and actually growing in popularity.
People actually gravitate toward those mom and pop bookstores. They kind of have more charm than your Barnes and Noble or your Borders. I mean, I used to hang out.
One of the two of those doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah, Border, yeah. I used to hang out at those two and Woodfield Mall, Deer Park Mall. And I got to say, I don't know if I'm going to miss, I mean, maybe the nostalgic part of me, thinking back to my high school and junior high days. But for the most part, I don't know if I'm going to miss shopping malls. I don't know. I just think, and I'm interested to hear what people think, but I think the alternatives that are popping up are just better. I mean, what advantage are you losing with the shopping mall? What besides your memories of being out at one? I don't know what consumer experience you're losing by there being fewer shopping malls out there.
Yeah, I don't know about that either. I kind of miss the idea of a shopping mall more than I miss the actual concept of a shopping mall. Got a call here from Brian. Let's go to Brian from East Chicago, Indiana. Brian, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, gentlemen. I want to ask you about your Christmas Day experience. You said that you got up drinking after to turn off the alarm or something, got out drinking champagne. Is that true?
Yes, that was accurate.
You got up drinking champagne. Do you think that's really a good image you want your kids to have on Christmas Day, you know?
Do you, to what extent do you think a five-year-old is cognizant of that, to the extent that it is even a problem, which I don't seed?
Well, I seem to remember memories of my dad and the parties that they had, and yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, well, I also think it's something to do with moderation and how you're drinking, and thanks for the call, Brian. I will say my parents drank in front of me all the time and I turned out average. So
yeah, my parents were perfectly content to consume an adult beverage. Look, this is one of the things that I have a problem with. I have a problem with the way that we as a society approach the idea of talking to kids about the consumption of alcohol as compared to, and you can all call and yell at me about this if you really want to, say the way that the French do it. The idea that we create this notion that this is like, here's this thing and you can't do it and it is off limits and it is bad, rather than trying to, and I think this is perhaps what Brian was trying to get to, and I would note that he mentioned parties, not the idea of like, you know, enjoying a bottle of champagne first thing in the morning. We weren't getting fall down drunk.
Right.
We're not having a rip-roaring party. There weren't a whole bunch of people coming over. There was no irresponsibility to be had. One can know one's limits and act in a responsible manner within the confines of one's own home, consuming a beverage, which you are of legal age to do so.
It actually sets a good example if you're drinking in moderation and you're just, it's a casual thing and you're not getting stupid with it. I saw my parents drinking when I was young as something they, you know, had a beer at dinner, a wine at dinner. It's not, you're setting an example of how to do something responsibly as opposed to this just like some forbidden thing.
Yeah.
That might entice them later on because it's forbidden.
And so, to the notion that it's like, you know, starting 6 a.m. with drinking something. Again, well, I don't know about your experiences. They may vary, but that's not the way I start my every day. Christmas is different.
Yeah.
It is a day like we didn't leave the house on Christmas Day. We're not going anywhere. We didn't, you know, again, it didn't go from like, you know, let's open a series of bottles of champagne and act like idiots. No, one can act in a perfectly responsible manner.
The grossest part about that story is the 4:30, 5 a.m., 6 a.m. part.
Yeah, tell me about it.
That's the thing you should teach your kids differently is that you can sleep in past when the sun comes up.
Believe me, if we're talking about modeling behavior, I try to model the behavior of not getting up at the crack of dawn, before the sun is even up. They don't emulate it. I wish I could say that I found this direct connection between behavior I have and what my children will emulate, but it doesn't seem to work. If it did, things would be a lot different. Like, for instance, they don't totally emulate the OCD compulsions that I have, whereas like the water-based toy that my daughter has been playing with for the last 2 days that gets water everywhere, which makes my skin crawl because of my obsessive-compulsive disorder compulsions. She wouldn't, you know, she'd be as nervous about that, but she's not. No, not a big deal. I wish they emulated more of the behavior that we set for them, mostly because we're generally responsible adults who also like to not get up at 4:30.
Well, like
in the morning.
We were saying before, they're like drunk young adults.
Yeah,
that's what a kid is.
Yeah.
So you're not that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy. Thank you so much for joining us. Be a part of the program with us today. Give us a call at 312-642-5600 or text DA to 64636. That's DA to 64636 to be a part of the program. We've got a lot coming up in the program today. I want to give you a sense of what you have to anticipate. Rory Broomfield is going to be joining us from across the pond to tell us what is going on with Brexit. Of course, there was the Brexit deal that Theresa May had negotiated with the European Union, which she did not have enough votes to get through Parliament. There was the failed vote of no confidence in Theresa May. What does all of this mean? That all happened about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. We haven't heard much about it since. So Rory Broomfield, who was a former director of the Freedom Association and the Better Off Out campaign, a Brexit, pro-Brexit group, is going to join us to tell us what is going on there. And then later in the program, Vincent Caruso, our colleague at the Illinois Policy Institute, is going to join us to talk about sin taxes in Illinois, and not the kind of sin taxes that I am probably using terribly in my construction of grammar here, but the kind that actually charges you for the things that you like to do, but you're not supposed to, apparently.
Drinking at 6 a.m. Yeah. With
your
kids.
Yeah, and that riles some people up, apparently. We had been talking, Joe, about things that existed 15 years ago on Christmas, or that didn't exist 15 years ago on Christmas, that exist now. I saw a lot of takes from people saying, I would go back to that world, the world that doesn't have any. Again, really quickly, here's the list. The iPhone, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, the iPad, Netflix streaming, Google Maps, Snapchat, Spotify, Android, Uber, Lyft, Alexa, Airbnb, the App Store, Google Chrome, WhatsApp, the Fitbit, Waze, Slack, Square, Dropbox, Pinterest, Venmo, Bitcoin, Hulu, and Kindle.
And you wait, so you said at the outset before you rattled off that list, you'd want to go back to that world, or you're just
Now, look, I would have been a few years ago the kind of person that would have said, you know, had this teleological belief in kind of the march towards the sunny uplands of history, that everything is improving and going to continue to improve. And I think if you look at the track of, like, you know, human progress, there's a great Twitter feed, Human Progress, website humanprogress.org, that tracks the way that society has improved, that our lives have improved. Fewer people live in poverty today. Like, the poverty rate has been cut by more than half in the last, was it 20 years, 30 years, something like that. It's a remarkable, remarkable accomplishment. But I think we're living through one of these periods of time. There's other ones in history that you can point to where you're having a lot of rapid change. Rapid, not only growth, but especially a rapid change in the way that people live and orient their lives. And I think we are struggling to deal with it. Now, whether or not I would want to go back and live in a period of time where the iPhone doesn't exist or Facebook doesn't exist, well, it doesn't matter. I can't snap my fingers and magically be in some, you know, better designed and probably not nearly as great point in history as we like to sentimentally recall. But in this list, are we better off for having the, you know, the iPhone, for having a computer in our pockets 24/7? Are we better off for having Facebook? I think you can separate those from things like, are we better off having Google Maps? Absolutely.
Of course. I agree. We don't know how to use all this, and it's kind of like an overload. But I think this stuff just corrects itself. And the one topic that I've always found interesting with, you know, all these different social networks is the idea that there's increased loneliness, increased anxiety over checking your Instagram or your Twitter feed over and over again. I think that's a real problem, but I'm of the belief that it kind of corrects itself. I think both the consumers and the creators of the social networks will adapt to those problems over time. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I'm of that belief that you just mentioned, that you said you had a few years ago, that everything is better. Everything will continue to get better, and I think the problem you just outlined will correct itself down the road. And it's hard for me to explain that because I don't know what that's going to look like.
Yeah, but I want to agree with you to a certain extent, but I also I think I may disagree on the side of it that you think it's going to correct itself on. I don't know if you've watched any of these hearings with the, you know, Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook or the CEO of Google, whose name I can't remember off the top of my head. If you watch these, or, you know, my favorite was the one with Jack Dorsey from Twitter, because just as a sidebar, I often wonder if Jack Dorsey and the other people who created Twitter, if they, like, wake up at 3 a.m. in a cold sweat thinking, oh, my God, we created the thing that got Donald Trump elected president. Because I kind of believe that they do. I don't, you know, I think a lot of the idea that there is these purposeful biases that these people are operating on is a little overblown. I don't think that they are politically conservative or politically on the right. I just don't think that there is enough evidence to support the idea that there is a purposeful conspiracy to, say, obscure conservative opinion. I think that's a little bit overblown. But I would go as far as to say I don't think any of the people who created Twitter are Donald Trump fans. And I can only imagine the feelings that they have about having created the device that is not solely responsible for him becoming president, but played a large role in it.
But it's also a device that could be the answer to, if you're on that side of the political aisle, could be the answer to removing him. Like, it could bring about a new movement. It could bring about a new candidate. The power of Twitter and the fact that it was able to help Donald Trump become president can help someone else become president. It can spur a movement. I mean, when I was in college, in journalism school, they always talked about, this is right around the time of the Arab Spring, how powerful Twitter was then.
Yeah.
And there are so many other positive examples. I just think, like I said before, it corrects itself, or you just look at the power that Twitter has and getting Trump elected, it can do so much more than that.
Yeah, let's come back to the whole idea of correcting itself and how it may correct itself. And the reason that I don't believe it's going to get corrected on the side that you seem to suggest it would be is if you watched these hearings, these people, Zuckerberg, Dorsey, the Google people, I think are incapable of necessarily correcting it themselves. In part because when, you know, Facebook is asked about the prevalence of fake news articles on their website and how they're going to deal with that, are we going to bring in fact checkers? The answer has almost entirely been from them, we'll just create a better algorithm. There's a lack of understanding that they seem to express, to me at least, of human nature, of the way human beings actually work, because they are these kind of super smart engineering mindset people that thinks you can turn the knobs the right way, press the right buttons, and everything will work perfectly. That they think that these things can actually be digital communities that, if not replace, can at least replicate the idea of real, in real life communities. And they just can't. And they're going to have to realize the limitations of the incredible, brilliant things that they've created if they are going to be able to correct it, which is why I think the correction is going to come from people changing their behavior,
that's
not executives and not the people who create these platforms.
I agree. And I think one will affect the other, but I think we can get to that in a second.
Yeah. So I would separate, again, some of these things in this list out from the others, Uber, Lyft. But some of it does kind of merge together, right? How do you call an Uber or Lyft without the iPhone in your pocket, without being connected to the internet 24-7? What are the things you'd mentioned earlier that, you know, on a truly serious note, the idea of this increased loneliness or separation from other people that these platforms seem to foster?
This is where I think the correction comes, because I think it comes from the consumer. It comes from the people who are consuming the different social platforms, because once we have a better idea of this loneliness problem, this anxiety that these networks create, and we have a better understanding of that, I think people could reject it or could influence how the platforms are created and how they operate.
Or they opt out themselves.
Or they opt out themselves. I'm not focused on Mark Zuckerberg changing his platform. I'm focused on the people who use it changing their consumption and their use of Facebook.
Yeah, going back to the conversation we were having earlier about the way that, like, children aren't necessarily going to perfectly emulate responsible behavior. They are children. One of the things that is really concerning is the spike in suicide rates, especially amongst young girls who seem to be more affected by the pressures of this online world. And I've battled within myself this idea of, like, sentimentality, of thinking, you know, oh, things were so much better in, you know, I was born in the 80s, but primarily I'm a child of the 90s, thinking that, you know, things were so much better in the 90s. We live wealthier lives now than we did in the 1990s. I think we could say we're generally better off for that. Again, this isn't teleological. This is not moving towards a, you know, necessary better end. It doesn't always have to get better. It can get worse. And this is one of the signs, to me at least, that while, you know, there is this sense of, and it is somewhat true, it is true, that we live wealthier, more comfortable lives, I don't know that people are happier with them, especially because we're inundated on a regular basis of our own curated lives to mean that are organized in a way to look better than they actually are.
Entirely. And I think that's kind of the breakdown of the shopping mall is an interesting thing, because there's this idea of losing community, and that leads to loneliness and isolation. And I mean, I remember going to shopping malls with my friends to hang out, which was a weird concept, even if I'm not, like, purchasing anything.
Yeah.
But I kind of look at it more. So I guess I agree on both on that one front of missing the shopping mall. But I also look at the marketplace and seeing, like, the internet as the new shopping mall. And, like, this is way better. This is a way better thing. And maybe that's because people don't consider the loneliness stuff as much. They don't think about the loss of community, because you're not consciously thinking about losing that. It's more of a thing you feel, and you don't realize why you're feeling it. I don't think the loneliness that's developing in young people and the isolation is something that they're cognizant of necessarily. I mean, they might know that they feel that way, but they don't know why.
Yeah, they have nothing with which to juxtapose it.
If you're a child of the early 2000s, you have no comparison.
You don't know a time that the internet didn't exist. You don't know a time that this wasn't basically the world you were living in. It's only gotten faster and, quote-unquote, better in the time that you've experienced it. But this also, I think, contributes to the negative polarization that exists in our society on particularly political grounds.
Entirely.
That this loss of community that, you know, if you're a Republican, that you went to church with someone who was a Democrat, you lived in a neighborhood with someone who was a Democrat, you went hunting with someone who was a Democrat, you were in the Elks Club or Knights of Columbus with someone who was a Democrat. It goes back to a time where if I were to ask you if you were a Republican or a Democrat, I would have to ask a follow-up question to find out if you were a liberal or a conservative. We've had this polarization that exists. It's a sorting. Again, it's these kind of things that are the results of, you know, human action, not human design. People have chosen, in a way, to live in this kind of world. And I'm wondering if, you know, people will try to find their way back to these civic institutions, try to find their way back to their churches, try to find their way back to places where you can be with other human beings as human beings.
People like the identity of being on this online community with other Republicans, other Democrats, other conservatives or liberals. But even while you're in that online community that you think you feel an attachment to, those people are thousands of miles away from you, and you have no actual personal sense of community. I think it's really fascinating because, on the one hand, you feel you gravitate more to this group identity online, but at the same time, you're farther away from the people who live next door to you.
We want to know what you think about this. Give us a call, 312-642-5600, or text DA to 64636 to share your thoughts with us. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy. Talking about whether or not you would get rid of some of the technological advances of the last 15 years, whether we're better off as a society for having them, kind of things we're sentimental about. It's Christmas time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You start feeling sentimental.
I remember when I was really into nostalgia.
When was that? Was it a good time?
Yeah, from what I remember, yeah.
Yeah, so like I said, you can separate some of these things out. We're definitely better for some of them. We're not necessarily better for others. Netflix streaming is a pretty phenomenal thing. It's pretty cool.
Yeah,
don't you think?
And I think that I think like movie theaters eventually will go the way of the dodo, and I don't know if that's something that you'd be sentimental about, but I don't mind it. But then again, that's like the loss of
yes
community.
And no. It depends. So there are certain movies that I think necessitate the kind of large screen experience that you're only going to be able to get at a movie theater, no matter how big televisions get, and you can buy a 75-inch television now, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But it's not the same experience. And unless everybody is going to be of a certain wealth level that you're able to install a home theater in your house and get that same kind of big screen feel, it's not going to be the same. And I'm thinking, you know, this is just since we said Netflix, and Alfonso Cuarón, one of my favorite directors, has this new incredibly dull movie out on Netflix called Roma. One of his previous films was Gravity, which kind of was necessitated to be seen on the big screen to fully appreciate the work itself. So yeah, I think in a certain way I will feel a little nostalgic for the theater going away, to the extent that it does.
Right. I think it'll be like how drive-in movie theaters right now are like dinosaurs. You could find one every so often, and it's kind of cool.
Where I grew up in Belleville, Illinois, the Skyview Drive-In is still there.
You can stumble on one every once in a while. I think that'll be what a movie theater is like at some point. I don't know when that will be. You bring up a great point. I remember I watched the movie Dunkirk, which needs to be seen
yes,
on a big screen.
Yes, absolutely.
I watched it on my iPhone on a plane because I was like, oh, I've wanted to see this for a while. And I watched it on my phone. I thought it was good but not great. And then I realized I should have watched that on a giant screen with surround sound or something because the whole experience, half the experience was ruined from watching it on my phone. So, that's a good point. But
I think what I think the way it will actually come out being is the way IMAX theaters, not necessarily the way they are now, but the way they like were 10 years ago, where an IMAX theater was something you had to specifically seek out, in the way that regular movie theaters used to dot the land.
Yeah.
And most of them are still there. They've had to change their business model. So to the point of these things can change, right? They've become these places now where there was a bar at the one that I took my son to see the Spider-Man movie yesterday. There was a bar at the movie theater. The food options have changed dramatically. It's still overpriced, but are you paying for that experience? And if you're fine paying for that experience, okay, that's the kind of thing that you're seeking out.
I think I might maybe overly so, but I just really trust the consumer to the point where even if these models aren't great, then they would fail. Like one that I think will eventually come once sports leagues relinquish their hold on them is streaming of sports directly to your computer. And I think that's a great idea. But if it's not, it'll fail because the consumers reject it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to podcasts of Joe Walsh and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy. Give us a call at 312-642-5600 or text DA to 64636. Friend of the station, friend to many of us, Guy Benson, over the Christmas break, over the weekend, asked people to rank these three movies, Christmas movies: A Christmas Story, Christmas Vacation, and It's a Wonderful Life. Your hot take, Joe.
If I'm ranking those, Christmas Story, Christmas Vacation, It was Wonderful Life, I would go in maybe in that order, or Christmas Vacation. I don't think there are a lot of outstanding Christmas movies. We talked about this a little bit off air. Christmas Story, I think TBS made it overrated by playing it for 72 consecutive hours. Christmas Vacation is entertaining. It's a Wonderful Life is like, it's a nostalgia factor. It's a quote unquote classic, so I think that's why people like it.
Yeah,
it's not.
Well, that's the funny thing about
movie though.
That's the funny thing about It's a Wonderful Life is that it's kind of an accident of history that the only reason that it became so ubiquitously played was because it had bombed when it debuted. And TV stations could air it for next to nothing. So since it was clearly a Christmas movie, they used it as a lot of filler programming between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And it becomes, retrospectively viewed as this classic, which, as my friend Emily Zanotti likes to point out, the big problem with that movie is, the supposedly great redemptive story. What actually is happening is George Bailey is creating a subprime mortgage crisis within the town of Bedford Falls.
Yeah, and that's
that's not as
heartwarming of a.
That's what I would like. So all of this great transformation that he goes about, having, leads him to create a investment program for housing that people can't possibly afford. That is going to eventually result in people losing a lot of money in foreclosures. I want the follow-up movie, like the dystopian future follow-up movie to It's a Wonderful Life. Like, it's a not-so-wonderful subprime mortgage crisis.
Less heartwarming, but maybe more entertaining, more realistic.
Yeah. Like for people that like cinema that is closer to realism these days, I think that is what you're going to get out of It's a Wonderful Life. Also, let's note, Jimmy Stewart, I think, is possibly the first actor. And there are a couple of guys out there who fall into this category. The first actor I can think of who played himself playing characters.
Yeah. And now, it's come so far on that road that now we have a president that's playing a character who played himself.
Yeah. Playing the president.
Yeah.
I saw, as I mentioned, the Into the Spider-Verse movie yesterday. And Nicolas Cage provides the voice of the noir Spider-Man, which is one of the best parts of the movie. It's Nicolas Cage doing crazy Nicolas Cage stuff, but in a limited enough role that it is not overwhelming. But Nicolas Cage is another one of those examples of, like, he's playing Nicolas Cage playing people. Bruce Campbell is another example. Plays Bruce Campbell playing a character. Bruce Campbell's character in Burn Notice, great show if you've never watched it, was Bruce Campbell playing Bruce Campbell playing a former CIA agent. And it's great, and it's entertaining. Yeah, so, no, hard pass on It's a Wonderful Life. I think I would go with that. I had a friend push back on the idea that A Christmas Story is even a good movie at all. And for me, the way that I explained it to this person is, and this is somebody, you know, younger than me, who grew up on the East Coast. And one, I think if you grow up in the Midwest, there's a bit more of a connection to that film because it's supposedly takes place in Indiana, I believe, but it's actually in Cleveland where the house is and where all this was filmed. Or maybe I got that backwards. But there's this Midwest connection, and there's also, like, you know, it. The kid in that movie was like my mom's generation. My mom had like a similar experience of my grandfather deciding it was actually on Thanksgiving of, we're not going to, we're not going to have to cook. We're going to go out for dinner, and he didn't bother to make reservations. The only place they could end up was a Chinese restaurant.
Yeah.
So there's, you know. I at least have that one generation of separation, or that parent to child generation separation, where I could kind of be shepherded through that movie again before TBS turned it into a marathon thing, which I agree does lessen the enjoyment, at least in my book.
So what is your, because you just kind of mildly crapped on two movies, what is your favorite Christmas film?
The ultimate Christmas movie, which is Die Hard.
See, Now this conversation online about is Die Hard a Christmas movie has become like the is a hot dog a sandwich of movie debates, which started out as something funny and then just became too much. Not only do I don't want to get too much into this because I hate the idea that I'm even participating in the conversation, but not only is it not really a Christmas movie,
it is,
unless everything's a Christmas movie. It's an above average movie. It's fine. It's all right. It's entertaining.
It's a very good movie.
It's fine.
It's a very good movie made mostly by the villain being one of the best movie villains of all time.
Sure, yeah.
Hans Gruber, especially Alan Rickman's first movie role. Heck of a job for his first movie role. And of course, it's a Christmas movie. Christmas is central to the plot. The whole idea is the party that opens the door for the terrorists and Hans Gruber to come in and hijack it is a Christmas party, which typically, I don't know what offices you have worked in. Most people do not have these kinds of you're there in this gathering any real time of the year other than Christmas. It is the one that is guaranteed. The Hans Zimmer score works Christmas music themes into the score. And the biggest tip off, and I can say this having recognized it from the fact that I am married to a woman who really enjoys Hallmark and Lifetime Christmas movies.
I do, too.
I could tell. I could sense this, Joe. You're a sensitive soul, and I could. I know you like them because they're always happy, and they always end with a fine couple getting together at the end. One of the keys, in addition to the fact that it happens during Christmas, the centrality of Christmas to the plot, is one of the characters will have a Christmas-adjacent name. And John McClane's wife's name is Holly.
Okay, that point is valid, and that's something I thought through. I'm going to push back a little bit. Is the 2006 romp The Breakup, starring Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston, a baseball movie? Because the two meet at a baseball game at the start of the movie. It's central to the plot. They wouldn't have gotten together without the baseball game. It takes place in the summer, which is around the time that people go to baseball games. Vince Vaughn is frequently watching Cubs games broadcast by Len Casper during the movie with rare little cameo appearances from such Cubs greats as Will Omen. I believe Ben Grieve is in a scene. Is that a baseball movie? Because baseball is central to the plot. That's the Pandora's box that you've kind of
I haven't seen the movie. I have no desire
to. It's an American classic. Right up there with It's a Wonderful Life.
It sounds to me more that this is baseball adjacent. That
that's the name of my punk band.
Yeah, yes. I remember seeing them open for Green Day back when. That couldn't have been possible. You're too young for that. Could they have met somewhere else? Yes. Could he be watching a different sport? Yes. could any of those things be said about the centrality of Christmas to the plot of that movie in Die Hard? No.
Needless to say, Die Hard to me is an above-average movie. It's good. It's entertaining. It's something like when I hear too much of something being phenomenal when I don't think it's that, it kind of makes me like the thing less. Forrest Gump's another movie like that where I hear too much about it and I think it's a fine movie.
Yeah,
to the point
it also
where
hasn't
like,
aged well.
I like aggressively don't like it. It's for NFL fans out there. There was this debate several years ago about is Joe Flacco the quarterback for the Baltimore Ravens, now backup quarterback, is he elite because he won a Super Bowl?
Mm-hmm.
Joe Flacco's a fine quarterback. He's good. Mm-hmm. But because he became elite, people started saying he sucked because they were impulsive to the idea that he's something more than he is. Die Hard's a Joe Flacco movie to me. That's where I'm going to – that's the hill I'm going to die on.
Well, as we talked about earlier, that it's one of our hopes that people can find their way back to communities that make them feel, you know, better about themselves, that give them a greater sense of grounding in the glory of this world. That is my New Year's and Christmas hope for you, Joe, that you can make your way back to some kind of a community that will allow you to recognize Die Hard for the amazing, glorious, wonderful, pretty much perfect movie that it is. But you're welcome to call and tell me I'm wrong about that. 312-642-5600. You can text DA to 64636 to be a part of the program. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in for Dan and Amy.
Main ventilation duct and bingo. This one's like a regular, normal Christmas eggnog Christmas tree. Little turkey, but no, I had to crawl around the tin can.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy. Call us 312-642-5600 or text DA to 64636. Joe, keeping with our conversation about things going away, you can thank Ohio Governor John Kasich for perhaps preventing something from going away for good. From National Review, Ohio Governor and former presidential candidate John Kasich this week signed a bill requiring elementary students to learn how to write in cursive, following over a dozen other states that have begun requiring cursive instruction for students who type on phones and computers more than they write by hand.
One of those states that they're following is actually Illinois, too. John Kasich, obviously, he's nationally known, so this kind of brings this to national news. But this is actually something that Illinois has adopted. State Representative Chris Welch from the western suburbs, Hillside area, introduced a bill, well, I want to say last year? It was a while ago, I think early 2017, to mandate cursive instruction all the way through high school. The bill was vetoed by Governor Bruce Rauner. The veto was overridden, and now cursive writing is mandated in Illinois public schools. I've heard a lot of people talk about this in Illinois, too, and this has kind of been the response nationally is some people say, well, how are kids going to read the historical documents or sign their name? And to the latter point, people were learning cursive and signing their name in like second and third grade. It's fine. Mm-hmm. You can move on after that.
Mm-hmm.
Historical documents, you can Google those now. Mm-hmm. It is 2018. And this is an example of something. I cede some of your points on losing things that, whether for nostalgic reasons or for actual community value, you don't want to lose. And sometimes technological advances will hurt the community aspect of something or hurt the just your memory of something. But this is an example of people who don't understand the times, Chris Welch, John Kasich, who are just, this is completely backwards. The idea that you need to mandate cursive writing through high school because you don't want to lose cursive writing. It's so sad that it's going away. That's something I don't understand being nostalgic about necessarily. In the point where nostalgia is kind of hurting public policy and is just making bad decisions.
Let's keep in mind that these are unfunded mandates as well, right?
Yes.
So this is additional instruction that schools are going to have to engage in. The time, if nothing else, costs money.
Not only an unfunded mandate, in the bill that Welch introduced, it specifically said the cost to schools is unknown.
Yeah, yeah. Which, good for them for finally recognizing some of the things that they make people do, that they make institutions do. They don't actually know what it will cost. Not so good that they didn't even try to figure it out. John Kasich, I just want to note, I appreciate a man with principles. So John Kasich, while governor of Ohio, has vetoed a bill that would ban abortion after 20 weeks. But we're going to have cursive instruction in school. And I appreciate a man willing to stand on principle like that. Cursive is going away to the extent that it is going away. I imagine students still need to learn how to sign their names in a way that is physical. I don't think that's ever going to completely go away unless we move to the kind of facial recognition or thumbprint recognition for everything, like your iPhone reading your face in order to open, which is not creepy at all. It's going away because the utility of it just doesn't exist in the same way that it used to. It's not like it's being actively destroyed. It's not like we're, you know, there are forces out there who are trying to kill cursive.
Anti-cursive lobby, the print lobby, is coming out to end cursive writing. It's going away because we don't need it as much. You need to sign your name on a check. You need to sign your name on just like, you know, a handful of things that you encounter in your daily life. But beyond that, it's just silliness. And you get it from a mope like Chris Welch or a mope like John Kasich. Doesn't understand that.
Well, this is just so perfectly emblematic of the problem with schooling today. And I purposefully use that word. Schooling in differentiation from education, right? Because we have compulsory schooling. We don't have compulsory education. And just the same with cursive like this as with, you know, this is the example that I use all the time of foreign language instruction. Decades now of research by experts tells us what? Where do children best learn foreign languages? Primary grades. Where did you take foreign languages when you were in school? Probably same as me, high school. Why? Because that's how we do it.
Yeah.
Why? Because that's how we've always done it. This is the mentality that government officials approach the idea of education with, that we should keep doing things the way we've always done them. Why? Because that's how we've always done them. Well, does that work? No, it's how we've always done it.
Why is the school day 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. or something roughly around then?
Yeah, because that's how we've always done it. Because it's the descendant of an agrarian economy when you needed, you needed the hours in the evening for boys to work. You needed summers off for boys to be able to work the fields. That is the world that they're operating from, with no real recognition that that's the world that they're actually operating from.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy. Be a part of the program with us by giving us a call at 312-642-5600 or text DA to 64636 to join us for the program. You may have heard in the news break, President Trump visiting the troops in Iraq. Even when it seems somewhat inadvertent, doing what he seems to have a talent for, which is making particularly people in the media make fools of themselves. You had a number of people trying to dunk on him, saying that, like, this is the first time since, I guess, the dawn of time or whatever, that the president didn't go visit the troops at Christmas time. Actually, Christmas time being the exact phrasing, which I thought was interesting, because if you actually know what you're talking about, at least with our current definition, Christmas time not only seems to begin before Thanksgiving, but you have the 12 days of Christmas, which are actually from Christmas to the Epiphany. So there was plenty of time in there. And of course, lo and behold, President Trump turns up in Iraq, visiting the troops there. And as somebody pointed out on Twitter, it's a great, if you're on Twitter, which I don't recommend, you should be.
It's one of the technological advances that you would advise against of that list that you read.
Going back to that conversation, of all of those things, if you told me one thing to get rid of from that entire list that we would just wipe out of existence, Twitter is easily the easiest pick,
but
at
anyway,
least for me.
You were on it and reading.
Nonetheless, here I am. Seeing, you know, people saying, you know, tweeting these articles about Trump not visiting, and of course then he shows up and they manage to own themselves by having tried to dunk on him for all of this. And it was Soledad O'Brien, former, I believe, CNN correspondent, who had said, you see, the shaming of him works. And former Fox News anchor Britt Hume's response was, you know, yes, exactly. Trump saw these tweets, traveled back in time to fly over to Iraq to be there. Great, you know, great take there. And someone pointed out these trips are planned weeks, if not months,
yeah,
in advance.
It's the president.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the president. You're taking the president of the United States into a forward area, into what is ostensibly still a war zone. And it's just the level of stupidity and people losing their minds that I have a hard time now, going on the third year of Donald Trump being president, have a hard time tolerating.
It's tiresome. You and I have talked about this before, and I think on other programs, that there's the anti-Trump camp. And I'm no big fan of the president, but there's also this anti-Trump camp. And you can kind of have your feet in both camps where you're like, you don't really care for the president that much, but the people who are making every decision he makes, World War III, those people are just as annoying, if not more so annoying. So you kind of have your foot in both camps. And that's kind of, I think, where you and I and many other people often fall.
Yeah.
Where you're just tiresome of the news cycle of everything is the apocalypse that he does. And that's where, I mean, that's where a lot of Americans are, really.
Yeah, people without a good sense of history. That's a good lead in to this story from Mediaite. Joe Scarborough, if you are familiar with Joe, host of Morning Joe on MSNBC.
Well, and I'll never forgive him, because if I ever hosted my own morning show, that's the name that I would want, and it's ruined. It's over.
It's a tragedy. Joe Scarborough opened the Boxing Day episode of Morning Joe. Happy Boxing Day to everybody in Canada listening to us. Yesterday was Boxing Day, of course. With one of his signature long-form monologues. Okay, first of all, I've never watched Morning Joe, or if I have, it was because I was a captive audience somewhere. Does he really do this? Is this like...
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no idea.
God help anybody who actually has to suffer through one of those. Signature long-form monologues that assess the current chaos surrounding the presidency of Donald Trump. In a 10-minute essay, systematically and dispassionately outlining what Scarborough sees as recent administrative, economic, legal, and foreign policy issues that have embroiled the White House in the last 2 weeks of a troubled 2018. The big thrust of all of this is that he said Trump is on track to be the worst president of all time. And, Joe, as you just mentioned, this kind of ignorance of history problem. That is incandescently stupid, skull-poundingly idiotic, because, and I will give you at least two examples of people who have no real frame of history. James Buchanan, the president that preceded Abraham Lincoln through his inaction at best and his deviousness at worst, basically left the country with no choice but to fight a bloody civil war.
Which is one of the worst things to happen to this country. Right.
Right up there
at 9/11.
Every single person who died in that war was an American. It was one of the deadliest wars that we've ever participated in. Again, Trump is not even into his third year yet. James Buchanan, certainly worse. And then there's Woodrow Wilson.
Who's my least favorite?
Don't get me really started on Woodrow Wilson, because I, you know, go back before, you know, Trump was even president. If you remember the Bush years, all the ridiculous stuff that people used to say about George W. Bush was almost all of it true of Wilson. But, you know, because this is where one of these you're in one of these weird positions. So Princeton, the kind of PC cultural freakouts that you get on college campuses where, you know, buildings named after people who are, and I hate this word, problematic, need to be renamed. And at Princeton, the government school is the Woodrow Wilson School. They're going through this freakout of like, well, should we rename it? And part of the reason was because undeniably the most racist president of the 20th century.
100%, yeah.
Resegregated the civil service, instituted a policy of including photographs with job applications to work for the government, so that if you couldn't quite tell from the name if the person was black, you could see from the photograph that they were, and you could then not give them the job. undeniably most racist president of the 20th century. And they now want to rename the school there. And this is like the famous line about the Iran-Iraq war. It's a shame both sides can't lose. It's like, yeah, the idea of memorializing Woodrow Wilson with, you know, a elite school at Princeton, where he was a professor, president, I believe.
He was president of the university,
You're the first academic to be president of the United States. Of memorializing him is disgusting. But at the same time, this, you know, purge everything problematic from our history movement is also idiotic. So it's a shame that both sides can't lose with all of that. But the lack of a historical knowledge to be able to make this idiotic, he's on track to be the worst one. What the heck does that mean?
Right. He's on track to be one of the best ones, too.
No, he's on track to be an average one. Yeah, it's like, is he kind of, you know, in my opinion, is he probably going to be, you know, on the lesser than average side of presidents? Probably. He has a chance to be on the upper,
He's on track to be president. That's the thing.
To be one of, you know, 45 people who've been president of the United States, and we'll only be able to fairly judge his legacy decades from now. That is something for the history books to determine, not for Joe Scarborough being a moron on his program to determine.
Well, here's the thing. So I think people have really small context for history, but a big part of this is, to go back to our discussion from the last hour, you have all this information piling in, and you can make takes in real time throughout the day with your favorite website, twitter.com. And that's not something you don't have all this information piling in during Woodrow Wilson's presidency, or especially not during James Buchanan's presidency, just to name those two again, where now you hear everything that's going on with the president. And I think, I mean, it's definitely intensified under Trump, and it's the worst it's been under Trump with all these takes coming out, all these worst president ever, blah, blah, blah. But the last three presidents, you've heard some variation of this is the worst president either of our lifetime or from their political opponents, or the worst president ever. You heard some conservatives say that Barack Obama was the worst president ever, or the worst president of our lifetimes. You heard people say that about George Bush. You heard George Bush was a traitor, was Keith Olbermann.
Bush Hitler.
Yeah, the Keith Olbermann famous rant where he said to shut the hell up to George Bush.
He's a fascist.
That's what I was looking for.
Which is really one of those Rorschach terms that, like, you throw it out there to mean whatever you want it to mean. It's in the Orwellian sense.
Yeah,
it means that of which I do not approve.
Comparisons to Hitler are starting to become like that, which is really not appropriate at all. But you hear some variation of all these takes under Trump, under Obama, under Bush. And I think a lot of that has to do with your just access to information now and the access to cable news and takes on Twitter, where you're getting all this polarization, and it's not even based on ideas. I mean, look at the Syria withdrawal. You have people on the left who should have been, I mean, 15 years ago would have been applauding the decision to withdraw from a country in the Middle East, who are criticizing it just based on the process of pulling out of Syria. Not the should we stay or should we not, just the process. He didn't consult with his generals. I mean, I think Barack Obama did somewhat of the same thing with Iraq, and I applaud both of them because I support the policy. And these are just kind of the opinions that you're getting are so lowbrow, so such low-hanging fruit.
Noam Chomsky.
Yes.
Was critical of Trump withdrawing troops from Syria. The man who has made most of his career complaining irrationally about American empire is opposed to withdrawing American troops from Syria. It just demonstrates, like, even, you know, Howard Dean, somebody, like, it took a matter of minutes for Howard Dean to make a pronouncement about, you know, Trump withdrawing troops from Syria. This is a horrible mistake. It's going to, you know, you can't possibly do this, to find Howard Dean only like 2 or 3 years prior saying, you know, we shouldn't have troops in Syria. The willingness of people to calibrate their positions based on somebody, whoever is in the White House at the moment, whatever they're saying, is just so incredibly frustrating. That nobody can be, if not at least, you know, intellectually consistent, because consistency, I think, is a much overrated value. If the facts on the ground change, your opinion should change. And when the facts change, my opinion changes. What do you do, sir? People just
Well, I was actually excited.
Only calibrate themselves to, like, you know, what partisan side that they're on. And this is the problem with some Trump supporters, too, is that everything is done in defense of one person. And it is all leading to this just incredibly stupid moment we're having that I think is only going to get stupider.
I was actually excited because of this reason when Trump came into office, because I didn't believe that he was going to be this guy who's non-interventionist in want to end the wars in the Middle East. I'm glad he's following through with it on Syria, but I kind of assumed he would be more hawkish just based on the people he was surrounding himself with and based on the fact that
Bolton is an advisor in the White House.
And I saw Obama become more of a hawk when he took office. I just assumed that every president was going to become more of a hawk, so I didn't really believe him. So I was excited for the return of the anti-war left that was around from 2000 to 2008. I thought they were going to come back. And instead, we have this hawkish left that kind of developed under Obama that's still around. And it's just frustrating to see.
Maybe this is the beginning of some kind of bizarre political realignment. I mean, it's, you know, these news cycles come at us so fast, it's almost impossible for us to really get a good grip on it, because Joe Scarborough can't even get a good grip on something for which there's 200 plus years of history for him to evaluate and thinks Trump is somehow going to be the worst president of all time, which is just moronic. You cannot enjoy the guy, and I don't particularly, and still think that that is just a stupid opinion. We want to know what you think. Give us a call, 312-642-5600, or text us, DA, to 64636. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, in today for Dan and Amy.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, in today for Dan and Amy. We're talking about some of the dumb freak out related to, well, anything Trump does at any given moment on any given day. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Joe in Franklin Park. Joe, good morning. Thanks for calling us.
Well, you're welcome. This is like, you know, your daughter's boyfriend. If you like him, he can't do no wrong. If you hate him, he can't do no right. If this guy was walking on water, Joe Scarborough would say, look, I can't swim.
Yeah. You know, it's and thanks for the call, Joe. Joe Scarborough, there's an irony in that, too, because go back to the beginning of this whole process. And Joe Scarborough was like one of the big boosters of Trump. He was one of these media people who was more than happy to give him all the airtime he wanted, all of that unearned media that Trump had that helped him, for lack of a better way to put it, hijack the process. All of that airtime he didn't have to pay for, Joe Scarborough was just as, you know, indulgent of all of that. So it's,
he was one of the biggest ones, too.
He
was a complete 180. He was one of the biggest, not, I don't want to say direct Trump supporters, but the amount of airtime he gave him
booster
on his little show. Yeah, like, booster, yeah.
Even if you were like, and you can go back and find, again, one of the other dumbest people on Twitter, Matthew Iglesias at Vox, I'll stand by it. Go back and find the tweets where he said that Marco Rubio is worse than Donald Trump is. And now compare that to the kind of culture of freak out that is going on at Vox.com.
I think back then they were doing that. He was making that statement based on policy, and he'd be right, because a lot of the things Trump supported was more to the left. Like, he could find some agreement with the Democrat Party when
he's just looking
at his policies,
which
as a political figure.
Goes to what we were talking about just a minute ago of like Noam Chomsky recalibrating his foreign policy positions to the fact that he hates anything Donald Trump does. Another good example of some of the stupidity, a college student at University of Massachusetts Amherst was forced to remove a sign from her dorm window that read, "Expletive Nazis, you are not welcome here." And the justification for this is that the university has a highly promoted initiative on campus called Hate Has No Home at UMass, aimed at rejecting, quote, all forms of bigotry and hatred. According to this, apparently, hatred of Nazis.
Yeah, I mean, this girl needs to clearly, like, invite Nazi. I mean, they should meet a Nazi quota at the school, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, in addition to whatever ethnic or all these diversity quotas you need to meet.
Start some kind of scholarship program.
Yeah, the Nazi scholarship.
It would be, it just, this amazing, just stupid time that we live in, the way that people can only, the come up with these visceral reactions where you actually are saying that, like, you know, one, there aren't any Nazis there. There really aren't. This was in response to a swastika being drawn over a Star of David, which, of course, is dumb and vile. But the idea that that person is actually a real Nazi is as dumb as the idea that she needs to take the sign down from her window.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity. Right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to be a part of the program, you can give us a call at 312-642-5600 or text DA to 64636. To join us. A whole lot more coming up on the program today. We're going to talk to our colleague Vincent Caruso from the Illinois Policy Institute a little bit later about what is going on with sin taxes in Illinois. That's going to be something interesting. A whole lot going on in Illinois. I want to go back a moment to what we were talking about with technology. Here's a question. It's from The Economist. Is it time to automate politicians?
Go on.
A poll of British consumers conducted by software firm OpenText found that 1 in 4 Brits think robots would do a better job than humans as politicians. Years ago, The Muppet Show ran a segment mocking politicians for their stereotypical robotic behavior. Last April, a robot was nominated to run to be Tokyo's mayor, promising fair and balanced representation. It sounds more like a Black Mirror episode than it does actual serious proposal. But I just love the idea that, one, of course it's Tokyo. Of course it's Japan. Mm-hmm. And two, the promise of fair and balanced representation is just, I don't know why, it just strikes me as fun.
I'm one of the people that is not afraid of the robots coming, and I welcome any kind of technological advancement where you have self-driving cars, I think are safer than people. I think robotic umpires or computerized umpires would be better for baseball. Heck, let's even make the players robots. Let's just have everything be a simulation. I'm okay with that. And this is a situation where, much like self-driving cars where accidents happen all the time based on human error, I think it could only be an improvement if human politicians are replaced by robots. I don't see how robots could do any worse.
We were talking about movies earlier. Have you seen the Terminator franchise?
I have, yeah. I'm familiar. Yeah.
So can I read this as perhaps liquidating humanity is now a proposal?
You could, that's one way you could look at it, or I could look at it as taking somebody like, let's just use the Illinois General Assembly as an example. Yeah. Most of us are living in Illinois. Taking a Mike Madigan, who I don't even know if he's actually human, so maybe he's not the best example, but the likes of a Chris Welch from the Western Suburbs that we were talking about earlier.
Mr. Cursive Man.
Yeah, Mr. Cursive, replacing him with a robot, or replacing, some of you might not like J.B. Pritzker, replacing him with a robot. I think these advancements, I've seen the work of the Illinois General Assembly. I've seen it. I've written about it. I've talked about it on these airwaves. I am okay with a robot replacement. I don't see how it could be any worse. And I need, this is even accounting for the Terminator franchise.
Yeah, mass extinction and death would be, be an improvement.
We're already on the way anyway. We all die at some point.
To that point, yes, your top inbound versus outbound states, Illinois, once again, leading the pack, roughly like 45,000 people left Illinois in the last year looking for more opportunity, more fertile ground in other states. They're going to a lot of our neighbors as well, so it dispels the constant suggestion, oh, it's the weather. Yes, yeah. People going to escape in the great...
I don't know if you've been to Indiana before, but it's lovely this time of year.
Especially this time of year. It's so bizarre a suggestion that like one struggles to take it seriously. I think I have to come back to the same point that I was making earlier about like Facebook and Twitter, and that we'll just come back. We'll create a better algorithm and everything will work itself out. No, governing humanity is a messy proposition.
I agree. I just think we've screwed it up.
Well, what kind of robot politician, like, what are you looking for in your robot politician before you're willing to give your support?
I mean, a lot of these people are already just pressing a yes or no button anyway.
In some cases, they're not even pressing their own yes or no buttons.
Yeah, you have a page.
This
is
regularly happens in the Illinois General Assembly that, yeah, you just have a page come down and press the button and vote for you. You don't even have to be there to vote.
Yeah, so I think you'd program these robots in a way that I think, going back to the umpire example, they'd be programmed to call a ball or a strike based on what a ball or a strike is, based on the second rule in the Major League Baseball rulebook. I think a robot politician would be programmed to make decisions based on what's best for the taxpayer. So the curse of writing bill comes to the Illinois General Assembly. You have robot Chris Welch there. He says, you know what? No, I'm not going to vote for an unfunded mandate. I'm not programmed that way. He votes no. Everyone else votes no. The bill dies 0-0.
You know, there
it goes into therein, the ruins.
Therein lies the rub, doesn't it? That the idea of course, who is programming our robot politicians? Are they being programmed to have the utmost respect for the taxpayer? Are they being programmed to maximize the value they can get for tax dollars? Or are they being programmed to serve, well, some other interests?
You download the Constitution into the robot. I don't know how you haven't thought this through very much. You download the Constitution into the robot, and then it's programmed to work on behalf of its constituents.
So the Constitution is going to, if you're an Asimov fan, is going to operate kind of like the three laws of robotics.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying I couldn't be talked into this. As someone who doesn't necessarily enjoy that our government has become as entertaining as it is, quote unquote entertaining, maybe a duller, roboticized government might be better.
Can't do any worse.
We want to know what you think. If you think robots could possibly do better than our current crop of politicians, or at least couldn't do any worse, call us at 312-642-5600, or you can text DA to 64636 to share your thoughts and be a part of the program today. Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser in for Dan and Amy.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, in today for Dan and Amy. Be part of the program with us, 312-642-5600, or you can text DA to 64636 to share your thoughts, just like Jerry in Batavia. Jerry, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Good morning. You're a very good replacement for Dan and Amy.
Thank you.
I like the TV. I wanted everybody to know that the TV is really cool. I am a retired scientist, and I've got an Apple X, and that thing is sentient. I had a setting on where it always says on the side. My wife and I were talking yesterday, and I said, you know, I'm not a bad singer. And Siri says, well, nobody ever said you were. And I said, what? You know? So then I said, you're supposed to say, hey, Siri, before you ask it a question. So I just said, Siri, are you listening to me? And she said, yes. I mean, a completely different voice than normal that she gives. She said, yes. And I've taught this stupid thing. It costs $1,000, you know.
Yeah.
I've taught it Russian, and now it's gotten back to the corporate, and now they are starting to program her to speak Russian. And when I was a scientist, I'm 76 years old. Mm-hmm. When I was a scientist way back in the 60s and 70s, I had to know five languages: French, German, I don't know, Latin, all of them. Anyway, I bought this thing to keep me from getting senile, okay? And you know what a pain in the ass the Apple X is? I mean,
yeah,
it's hard to work. So anyway, it's listening to me. And, it's incredible. And nobody realizes, we are being taken over by the computers and the sentient beings that are out there.
Jerry,
I'm curious to know what you think.
Yeah, Jerry.
Thanks so much for your call, Jerry.
Thank you for your call. I just got the iPhone X, and for a while that was a fear of mine, especially with the facial recognition. I'm just accepting it now. I know if I'm talking about something, there's going to be an ad for it on my Facebook because the computer's listening. I know, my iPhone's listening. I used to have a Samsung TV, smart TV, that turned off by itself all the time. And I heard later, it could be BS, but I read later on that that's some kind of spying technique, that it's watching you when it turns off by itself. It used to freak me out. It's whatever.
Yeah.
Everyone's watching me anyway. The NSA is listening to me.
Yeah.
We're all going to, as I was saying before, we're all going to die someday. Eat Arby's. It's fine.
We have a Amazon Echo, which there's plenty of these stories now of it, it listening and apparently sending recordings of conversations people have had to other people. There's people who have been reporting stories of, they're talking about something just in casual conversation, and then you start getting served up digital advertising for whatever it was that you were talking about. So, how do you draw the line between, how possibly crazy this sounds and to what extent it is happening? You have this passive microphone, you're carrying a microphone around with you everywhere you go. It'd be surprising if it wasn't listening to you.
We both have our phones out right now on the desks in front of us. They're listening to this conversation about the phones listening to us.
I wonder if they feel in the same way that if you overhear a conversation about yourself, do they feel awkward? Again, to go back to the canon of this, which is the Terminator franchise, the best/worst line of Terminator 2, which is a better movie than the first one, is the ridiculous Arnold Schwarzenegger, "I know now why you cry, but it's something I can never do." One, curse you, James Cameron, for having to put that line in there. And then deciding apparently years later that you're going to have to subject us to 3 or 4 Avatar sequels that no one asked for. But it can feel. I don't know. How do you know? You don't know. Maybe it's getting upset at the conversation we're having about it right now.
Right. There's also I've heard that with the Amazon Echo, there's a benefit. I mean, this is very, very, the odds are very low, but I've heard situations of the Amazon Echo. You could figure out a murder based on the Amazon Echo recording everything that's going on, even when it's off. And there are some silver linings to all this intrusiveness of technology. If you look at those very remote examples, very few and far between. So maybe maybe these things have our best interests at heart. Maybe the ads pop up on Facebook because it wants us to have the things that we're talking about that we think we're talking about in private.
Well, yes, I've always regarded the idea of people getting incensed about targeted advertising to be somewhat bizarre. Look, we're going to be advertised to. If you remember being a kid and watching Saturday morning cartoons, there were commercials for toys and breakfast cereal. Now, with having children of my own, we're relegated with, assaulted with the commercials for all kinds of toys that instantaneously my children decide they never knew existed, but now they have to have. The idea that, this kind of blast blanket advertising is better than it actually trying to show me things that I might want or not even necessarily need, but at least be helpful to me, that would be products that would be helpful to me, is a bizarre complaint. I just find that to be a bizarre complaint, that you'd rather have things not relevant to your life advertised to you than things relevant to your life advertised to you.
It's the whole idea of the intrusiveness of it and feeling like your privacy is violated because you're not consenting to the conversation that gives people the information to have ads targeted to you. But wait until those people who are bothered by that find out what the government is doing.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You think that's bad? You think the Facebook targeted ads are bad? Wait till I tell you about the National Security Agency.
Yeah, yeah. But they're just trying to keep us safe, Joe.
Sure.
They're just trying to, keep us safe by regularly and routinely compromising our privacy. It's for our own good.
I think I would rather have my privacy compromised by a targeted ad. Like right now, I'm just scrolling through my Facebook. I have an ad for, I don't even know why. I'm not a car person. I have an ad for Audi. I would rather, that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been served up ads for multiple different meals, the mail order meal services that I think most of them are interesting.
Because you Instagram all your meals?
I used to do that. I don't do that as much anymore. But yes, I did used to do that. Hashtag plated pics. I find it to be, if we're going to live in this world, at least it's like helping show me things that are more interesting rather than less interesting, which I think is pretty much all you could really want. But yeah, I've never had a conversation with Siri like that.
I've never, I don't think I've ever intentionally used Siri. I don't find it useful.
I did do one thing. I did. I changed it to like this very nice female British voice, which I find just to be more interesting.
Do you find that intrusiveness more pleasant?
Yeah, I do. I like the idea of this, like, you know, nice, attractive sounding British female telling me the directions to wherever I'm going.
That's fair.
Yeah, I think it's
each their own.
If I'm going to have fun with it, I'm going to have fun with it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser. In today for Dan and Amy, be a part of the program by calling us at 312-642-5600 or texting DA to 64636 to share your thoughts with us. And we live in a time of political disruptions. One of the examples of that is our current president of the United States, Donald Trump, is a bit of a disruptor of the moment. Another example of one of these disruptions of what had been the reigning political order is Brexit. The vote back in June of 2016, when almost 52% of the United Kingdom voted to withdraw from the European Union. So that is all proceeding. In the last several weeks, we've had some interesting events with that. There was the negotiated Brexit deal that Theresa May, the Prime Minister, discovered did not have enough votes to get through Parliament. And then there was a vote of no confidence that was attempted. Which came up short as well. So with a deadlines approaching for a deal for Brexit, we wanted to find out more about what is going on there, what it is going to mean for that country and for leaving the European Union. And to get some insight on that, we're joined by Rory Broomfield, who is the author of The Future's Bright, The Future's Global, and a former director of the Freedom Association and the Better Off Out campaign. Rory joins us now. Rory, thank you for joining us.
Hello, pleasure to be here.
So Rory, I wanted to ask, we've had the two most recent events, at least as we consume it over on this side of the pond, have been the failure of Theresa May's negotiated deal and then the vote of no confidence. Can you walk us through your thoughts on what those mean? Why did that deal fail? Why did the vote of no confidence fail?
So the deal is actually still on the table, in a sense. So Parliament never actually voted against the deal. The Parliament never actually voted at all to ratify the deal. And this agreement with the European Union, between the UK government and the European Union, has to go through all parliaments of the European Union, including the UK's, to be ratified. And it was delayed because the government realized it didn't have the votes. It didn't have the votes to get through, and as a result, the government is now behind closed doors with EU negotiators and counterparts trying to change the text and get reassurances and legal changes so that when they do put a renewed agreement back on the table, so to speak, then they have a greater chance of winning that vote in Parliament. You are right to say, though, there was a vote of no confidence, or indeed a vote of confidence, or in the Prime Minister. That was, though, in her own party. It wasn't a vote of confidence in Parliament. It was in the vote of confidence in her own party. I hasten to add, she had to guarantee she would be standing down before the next general election to win that vote of no confidence, or indeed vote of confidence. And so we just see there's a cauldron of excitement and expectation about what the government can actually bring back to ensure not just Theresa May's political life limps on over the next couple of years, maybe, but also to ensure that the deal actually gets through Parliament.
Were you surprised that the vote of confidence was not successful, that she was not ousted? Did that come as a surprise to you?
It wasn't a surprise to me because of the timing. If it had been earlier, as part of the Conservative Party tried to orchestrate it, then there was a higher degree, in my estimation, of her losing that vote of confidence. The result of it being so delayed and being just before Christmas and indeed being just before this deal, or just after this deal was meant to be voted on, that effectively turned itself into a party management question than a ratification on the deal itself. The political system in the UK is far more led by the whipping system with regards to the politicians and parties than it is in the US. And actually, the UK's political deal with the EU that had been delayed was far less important, in my view, governing the votes of confidence in Theresa May than party management, keeping the party together. And so that's why I thought it wasn't a surprise when she gained 200 votes to the 130-odd. She won a comfortable margin and survived to be Prime Minister the following day.
Where's public sentiment on all this? I mean, Eric mentioned the original Brexit vote totals at the outset, but has that shifted at all as new developments have been made in one direction or the other?
There are numerous polls out there discussing a variety of circumstances and scenarios. The issue really is whether you respect the poll that was conducted on 23rd of June 2016, which is yet to be implemented. And then, of course, there was a further general election in the UK last year where 80% of the members of Parliament were elected on a manifesto promise of leaving the European Union, its customs union, its single market and everything else. And so the question is, do you respect those polls or do you respect the variety of different polls that are coming around, whether they be sponsored by particular news organizations or individuals? It's very hard to tell. But we do know the definitive answer that was given in June 2016 and the following year, that the British people, when it comes to the vote, when it comes to voting, want the UK to leave.
The deal that had been negotiated, you said it's still on the table, it hadn't been voted on. What is your opinion of that deal? Is it sufficient? Does it work for you? If not, what problems do you diagnose it with?
Well, actually, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, summed it up best. He actually said this deal is a good deal for the EU. It's actually a very bad deal for the UK. And he was completely right in that conclusion, that very neat summary. And it's a bad deal for the UK for two principal reasons. I think what your president, Donald Trump, would have been saying, he would have been saying it's more about trade and the trade consequences of the deal, which wraps the UK up to respect what's called the Common Rule Book or in legal terms, the acquis communautaire, which is the legal system of the European Union, when it comes to trade, and will make a trade deal with the US far harder to achieve. But politically, the issues with Northern Ireland and Ireland is a key driver in why it was so unpopular in Parliament. Effectively, according to the Attorney General of the UK and his legal advice, what's called the backstop, which was negotiated within the withdrawal agreement, would tie the UK to the European Union indefinitely. That was his advice, the use of the word indefinite. If, of course, that deal were to be approved by Parliament and the other parliaments in the European Union. So there's a trade issue, and then there's a political issue, and they're both favouring the European Union, they're both harming the UK, and they're both restricting the UK in what it could possibly do after it leaves the European Union, albeit in name, going from March 2019. So the deal, if of course the deal is ratified, so the deal itself is bad politics and it's bad news in trading terms for the UK, not just with other parts of the Commonwealth, current Commonwealth of the United Kingdom, but also with a key trading partner that is the United States.
Given the travails that she has gone through, do you believe that Theresa May is in a solid enough political position to be able to negotiate a better deal that sufficiently addresses the concerns that you've just raised?
I find it hard to believe. Never say never in politics, especially when it comes to politics of this sort of free-brile atmosphere, this cauldron of excitement in the UK that is currently happening. But the European Union and the other heads of governments around the European Union have said that they have already agreed a deal, that there is no room for negotiation in changing the legal texts which would be needed to win over Theresa May's backbenchers in her own party, those that instigated the vote of confidence or no confidence, and indeed others within Parliament who are sympathetic to the Conservative Party and its idea of leaving the European Union, such as the Northern Irish Party, the Democratic Unionist Party. It may come to pass that Theresa May puts forward her renewed, as she spins it, and her people spin it, withdrawal agreement, and actually it's voted through with the opposition supporting it rather than her own party, which would make for an incredible new chapter in British politics, which would make the last few months of Brexit negotiations and the theatre that has really come to the UK as a result, the political theatre, it will make that look like an opening act. It may make it look like just the aperitif on the wider meal, the meat on the bone that would be the chaos that could bring to the UK. So all in all, this deal could go through. It may not satisfy everyone in her party. It certainly wouldn't on current terms satisfy me, but it may go through on the basis of opposition votes.
Very interesting. Well, new political orders kind of seem to be the order of the day, at least they are over here. But very interesting. Thank you for the insight so much. Rory Broomfield, the author of The Future's Bright, The Future's Global, former director of the Freedom Association and the Better Off Out campaign. Rory, thank you for joining us this morning.
Pleasure.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy. Be a part of the program by calling us at 312-642-5600 or text DA to 64636. Interesting to see that we're not alone in these kind of tumultuous political times, that kind of our oldest and most important ally also experiencing some interesting political machinations. I find what's going on over there fascinating. My own position on my own thoughts on it is that I'm not necessarily pro-Brexit. I'm pro-respecting the will of the people as they voted. Yeah. I think it is tremendously difficult. It sets a terrible precedent if there were to be a second referendum, because it's like the same reason that I'm opposed to recalling politicians. It's like you don't get do-overs in that sense. Like, you know, if it, in an electoral sense with politicians, you know when they're going to be up again. And if you don't want them to be governing your state, your city, whatever, vote them out. You don't get to regret your choice and get rid of them early.
Yeah, I'm of the same opinion that I respect the will of the people over there. I don't live there, but I do find it interesting. And yeah, with the second referendum, I mean, you kind of saw this when Scott Walker was recalled as governor of Wisconsin.
Attempted.
Well, they made the effort to recall him. Part of the rub with even like people in the center, people of who aren't overly partisan, was they didn't think the recall was warranted. They didn't think it was. I mean, even if they disagree with the political decision, a recall was used to, you know, get somebody out of office who was corrupt or did something illegal or some kind of malfeasance. And this was just like a policy disagreement they had.
Yeah.
You don't get a, like you said, you don't get a do-over on an outcome you didn't like.
Yeah.
The do-over you get is at the ballot box the next election.
The next election that comes up. And even with the idea of, like, you know, criminality, malfeasance and all of that, there is a mechanism for that. It's impeachment and removal from office. You know, there, just because people don't like or think I have a friend who is very much of the anti-Trump persuasion, who likes to bang on about the idea that, you know, these systems don't work because, like, impeachment and removal from office for Donald Trump is not going to happen. Ergo, the system is broken. We need new systems. I find this, again, to borrow a term, problematic, because one, if you're going to get a new system, first, you need to get it through a constitutional amendment, which is basically what you're seeding is not going to happen. If there's not enough public will to impeach and remove the president, there's certainly not going to be enough public will to amend the Constitution to deal with what you perceive as this kind of momentary problem. You know, the people in the United Kingdom spoke, and whether or not I think it is a good idea doesn't really matter, not only because I'm not a citizen there, but also because they had a chance to make their voice heard. They did. I believe it's correct that more people turned out for that election than have for any, you know, ballot question or election in the UK in quite a long time. So clearly it was something people were animated about, and it won. So now you have a duty, and I get that it's, you know, it's messy. What I thought Rory said was interesting is that Theresa May, in this kind of politically stunted position she's in now, may not be in a position to get a good deal. So what does this actually look like? It's going to be interesting to watch this unfold over the next several months to years.
The Trump impeachment, bringing that up, is a good example for the kind of thing over here where people kind of jump to the impeachment conclusion. Like, we can, if we get X amount of votes, or if we create this, if we get the majority in Congress, we can impeach Trump. Yeah. But that's just not how it works. You can't impeach George Bush over the Iraq war. I mean, you physically could, but it's not like you see a policy disagreement and
you can.
You have the mechanism.
Yes, the mechanism exists.
But that's just not how this thing, that's not how we go about things.
Your complaint is that the public will to do so does not exist. The political will to do so does not exist. And that is a qualitatively different problem than saying that, you know, the system is broken because you can't snap your fingers and remove Donald Trump from office in the magic way that so many people seem to want to do so.
And it's a good thing that the public will doesn't exist for these knee-jerk reactions, like removing a president over a few policy disagreements, or removing a governor in Wisconsin over a policy disagreement.
There's a reason that these things are supposed to be slowed down so people do not do these kinds of rash, poorly thought out things. There should be political will before you try to do anything like that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11 right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Eric Holm, Joe Kaiser in today for Dan and Amy. Be part of the program by giving us a call at 312-642-5600, or you can text DA to 64636. Joe, you know as well as I do that living in Illinois is taxing. See what I did there?
Yeah.
What I did there? You see it?
Yeah. It was okay.
We got one more day for me to round out this. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, Joe and I will be back tomorrow for another edition of Chicago's Morning Answer with these fill-in hosts. If you don't like what you hear today, just forget I said anything.
Tomorrow's number is going to drop a ton because you gave the disclaimer today.
But. Yeah, well, you know, what can you do? But yes, in addition to one of just in general the highest tax burdens that anybody anywhere in the country faces, Illinoisans face a healthy number or an unhealthy number, perhaps, of excise taxes, better known as sin taxes. And to shed some light or perhaps sober us up about this reality, we are joined right now by Vincent Caruso, who is a writer at the Illinois Policy Institute. Vincent, thank you for joining us. Vincent?
Hey.
Hey, there we go.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
So you have detailed in this story at illinoispolicy.org what is going on with excise taxes, sin taxes, as they are also known in Illinois, that Illinoisans face some of the highest in the nation. What do Illinoisans face in terms of sin taxes?
Well, they face a tax burden that is increasingly reliant on unstable revenues levied through excise taxes. The Tax Foundation has found that these are among the least reliable revenue sources in the country. And Illinois, as the Tax Foundation found, increasingly is relying on sales taxes that are of this excise tax category.
So what are some of those, first of all, what are some of those categories that Illinois is doing, has increasingly high excise taxes on?
One that was particularly sorry, I had to change rooms. One that grabbed headlines earlier this year, actually just a couple of weeks ago, is the state's wireless tax. It's now the highest in the nation after being just fourth highest last year.
So that's interesting. So what, so the wireless taxes, we've talked about sales taxes, which of course is something that I'm sure people are readily familiar with after going through the Christmas season. So the, like something like the soda tax would fall into this category as well, correct?
Right. Yeah. And we saw that consumers are actually, they about had it with excise taxes because that made history according to the Wall Street Journal that, they actually had a
I think we may have lost Vincent.
Well, I was going to say, I was glad that he switched rooms because I thought he called us on a toaster.
And the toaster
was cutting in and out. But
yeah. I'm beginning to think that Vincent didn't pay his tax bill on a cell phone.
He was so against his cell phone taxes that he refused to pay the bill altogether.
Or may I suggest that Siri is listening to this conversation.
Oh, it's Siri's
pissed.
And
Siri is now an agent of Mike Madigan and does not approve of what she is hearing.
Yeah, well, Siri's just kind of angry with us in general, so I feel like that could be part of it. But also, I mean, Vincent's right with the cell phone taxes, and that could be, you know.
Well, he was right about the point he was making with the soda tax as well. It's a remarkable story that, you know, on two levels, kind of an optimistic one and a disappointing one. The optimistic one is this tax is implemented and boom, boom, boom. People react to it. They are not happy about it. And they are managed to get rid of it in pretty much record time. The disappointing thing is these same people have watched their property taxes grow and grow and grow and grow. And yet there seems to be no, as the regular host of this program, Mr. Prof, would suggest, the kind of revolt that you would need to push back against property taxes.
Well,
like that.
It's because soda is a thing, it's a regular thing that people consume, or sugary drinks, almost every day. The tax affected so many regular people in a way that they don't think about property taxes or income taxes. They don't. But when you're going to the store and you see an extra few cents attached to your bill, all of a sudden, then you start to get angry about it. And sin taxes, I think, you see that more often. Soda tax is the big example, but you see people go to Indiana all the time to buy their cigarettes, pick up fireworks mm-hmm. while they're mm-hmm. there. Maybe do some grocery shopping while they're in the area mm-hmm. because they see that more. They look at their receipts when they go shopping. And that's why I think you see the revolt with the soda tax, and you see more of a gripe with these kinds of taxes than you do property taxes, even though the property tax bill, the biggest one, is the one you should be revolting over more so. These are just easier to digest and easier to revolt against.
And looks like we have Siri has relented. We have Vincent back with us. Vincent.
Did you find a new potato to call us on? What's going on there?
Yeah, is that what sounds like?
That's good. So I want to get your before we're done here. I want to get your thought on this. You had mentioned that this is unstable revenue. These sin taxes or excise taxes are unstable revenue. Why is that the case? Why is it not advisable for the government to be relying on this version of taxation?
Well, because they're relying on the behavior of consumers, which in any market is fickle. But when you're relying on taxing behaviors that can be particularly perceived as unhealthy or undesirable, take cigarettes. Cigarettes have been basically falling out of favor since the 1960s pretty steadily. And as a result, if you're relying on tax revenue from taxes that are basically tied to use of those products, then you're going to end up quite short of projections, which is exactly what the Illinois, Department of Revenue has found. Last time the cigarette tax at the state level was raised, I believe that was 2012, and the Department of Revenue discovered that they received $120 million less than it had originally budgeted for.
This is, so you bring them up, and it's always one of my favorite examples of the duplicitousness of people who advocate for these kinds of things, because on one hand, you have cigarette taxes, people who advocate for them saying, you know, it's like, these are going to be great because we're going to raise the cost of cigarettes, and therefore fewer people are going to smoke, and that's a good thing because smoking is not good for you. And then out of the other side of your mouth, you get the, and we are also going to get all of this revenue, which, of course, we've already budgeted for, that is also going to fall short of our expectations, which is going to create a deficit in terms of what we plan for and what we actually get.
Tony Preckwinkle basically said that soda's not bad. Soda is bad for you. That's why we're going to tax it. And mm-hmm. we're also relying on this revenue.
Right.
It's unreliable because it's inherently contradictory in its objective.
So, Illinoisans who are looking at these incredible excise taxes, is this, you know, primarily a state problem? Is it a local problem? What end of the spectrum more so are we seeing? Where are they coming from, Springfield or your local communities?
Well, it's both. Illinois has some of the highest excise taxes in the nation, highest sin taxes in the nation, but also the city of Chicago is also unique in that it is increasingly relying on revenue from excise taxes. I just mentioned before I got disconnected the on wireless taxes now outpacing that of any other state in the mm-hmm. nation. Mm-hmm. That's largely due to increases in taxes and fees raised at the local level, predominantly in Chicago. However, there's a relationship between what Chicago's taxing tendencies and the state's. You saw Rahm Emanuel, I'm sure, just a couple of weeks ago, coming out saying the state needed to at least double its gas tax on infrastructure. Largely concentrated in Chicago and the Chicago area.
Well, it's for the people talking about sales taxes that we led off this conversation with, just so you people know, it's not just Chicago that is, you know, has this reputation for incredibly high sales taxes. A sales tax referendum that passed in Springfield makes Springfield, Illinois, have one of the highest sales tax rates mm-hmm. in the entire country. So it really is a problem all over the state of Illinois, and doing a good job covering it. Vincent Caruso, a writer at the Illinois Policy Institute. Vincent, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Eric Cohn, Joe Kaiser, filling in today for Dan and Amy. We talked with Rory Broomfield about kind of the unpredictability of politics, how it is hard to know exactly what is going to happen. Many people certainly would not have predicted that Donald Trump was going to be the president of the United States. But some people attempt to predict these things.
Yeah.
And by those people, I mean degenerate gamblers.
I mean, degenerate is,
I say it lovingly.
Degenerate gamblers and gamblers and synonyms. So What's interesting, gambling on politics has kind of gained a little steam in recent years. It's a big thing that this website Paddy Power in the UK was doing for a while, putting out lines on elections. And it makes sense because it's basically a game in a way. Like, you have a winner and a loser, so why not?
Mm-hmm.
I think you should be able to gamble on anything. My roommate in college and I bet on the People's Court for a while. We'd pick somebody, and then the winner would get a cash prize. And today,
which is usually more than the people in those cases got, so that's good for you.
Today, I was gazing at the presidential odds. This is to win the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
So not just Republican nomination or Democrat nomination, but to win the whole thing, presented by Bovada, a sports book online. And, of course, Donald Trump. Now, what's interesting about this is so that somebody sets the lines, but then the public, this is a reflection of what the public is feeling because that's how the lines move. Donald Trump is, of course, the favorite because he's the incumbent. Best odds. His odds are plus 150, which means if you bet $100, you get your money back plus 150.
Mm-hmm.
Then after him, the favorites on the Democrat side would be Beto O'Rourke and Kamala Harris. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren in the next tier. Then you get into weird areas with like Mike Pence, if Trump doesn't run again or if Trump's impeached or something. Hillary Clinton, Kristen Gillibrand, Oprah Winfrey, Michelle Obama.
Oh, this is some of this is remarkable to me as I'm looking at the same numbers you are, that you have serious people. Like, take, for example, John Kasich, who I'm not a huge fan of. I think Jonah Goldberg is correct that he is largely a human toothache. But the current two-term governor mm-hmm. of the state of Ohio, former presidential candidate,
who's
member
hinting
of Congress,
at the possibility of running,
who actually has, yes, given serious indication that he may run for president. And according to this, a person with better odds of becoming president, not by much, but still better, Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Which I guess if The Rock ran on the Democrat side, he could be like their Trump. But like in the celebrity status, I think he's much more articulate. But yeah, that's crazy. But this is the way the public's kind of feeling. And I think a lot of these numbers are ridiculous. Like Rand Paul, who I don't think is going to primary Trump, but his odds are worse than Ben Shapiro's. Ben Shapiro's not going to run for president, people. Mark Zuckerberg has better odds, too. It's just like, it's interesting to look at this because, one, gambling's fun. Games of chance are fun. But also, it's a good reflection of how people are feeling. And it's like they're starting to see the unpredictability, or they're just interested in the celebrity aspect. I think even people who don't like Donald Trump are somewhat interested or intrigued, even for bad reasons, about the possibility of celebrity presidents. That's why you see The Rock on here. That's why you see Oprah, Kanye West, Joe Rogan's on here, Tom Brady. Like, some of these are just so incredibly outlandish.
I'm not the originator of this observation, but I think it is an accurate one. And for all of the people on the left who are not fans of Trump, who are pointing to this and kind of laughing at it and saying that, you know, ha, 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 you guys let this reality show star come in and take over your party, and now he's president of the United States. Very much the joke is going to be on them, I think, because you exhaust the Republican Party's list of celebrities somewhere around Ted Nugent and Scott Baio. Whereas, tell me, if you don't honestly believe that Tom Hanks or George Clooney or Oprah, if they would have jumped in the last election, that they wouldn't have kind of immediately been the odds-on favorite, would almost certainly have won. And one of the problems of all of this is none of these people have any idea how to govern. And we find this in with regard to, you know, look, some of the things that have come out of the Trump administration, I am a fan of. A lot of it has been Mitch McConnell pushing this agenda through the Senate. Donald Trump has never been in government before. And for the people, and this is one of the ticks of the right that has always driven me nuts, the idea of we're going to run the government like it's a business. The problem is, it's not a business.
Exactly.
The incentives are not the same. Managing it is not the same. And being a celebrity and thinking somehow George Clooney is going to have any better of an idea how to run the government is nuts.
That bench on the left is so big in terms of celebrities. And one name that comes up here, and I think, I mean, he's kind of on the left. If he had to pick between the two major parties, he'd run as a Democrat. But Mark Cuban, who said, he's on the record of saying, had he run for president in 2016, he would have beaten Trump one-on-one.
He might not be wrong about that.
He might be right, but that's the thing. It's like he has a much better demeanor. He's much more articulate. He's a nicer guy. But I don't think Mark Cuban really knows anything as successful as he is in his private life about governing the way Donald Trump doesn't know anything about governing.
I think he'd be endlessly frustrated by it. I mean, another example of someone who I actually think is falls into the category of somebody who not only seems like they've expressed an interest in running, that could run, that could potentially win the nomination and perhaps win the presidency. To me, coming in kind of the middle of this pack, Howard Schultz, who was CEO of Starbucks, that seems to me, he seems to have kind of tipped his hand that maybe he's actually considering this. That's an interesting, it'd be an interesting one for me to bet on if I were a gambling man, which I'm not.
Well, I am, and I do find that interesting. I find Mark Zuckerberg interesting also, but I find also like half that list terrifying too. But if you want to like have an emotional hedge against that, if you're afraid of Mark Zuckerberg being president, plus 6,600, bet like $2 on him. You know, that way, if he becomes president, you're upset about that. You at least
I'll make some money off of it.
Yeah.
I want to know, so the three people with the longest odds to become president, according to this list, are Joe Rogan, Tom Brady, and Will Smith. And what I want to know is, if Will Smith is elected president of the United States, will we be required to change the national anthem to an original super family friendly rap by Will Smith?
All right, let's end the show on that one.
Are you saying that we can't possibly go up from there, or we can't possibly get any worse than that observation?
You know, I said in the outset that everything gets better, but that might be a challenge to that whole thing. We're going to go from Donald Trump to, you know, like Miami as our new national anthem.
Wild West? I mean,
Yeah.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.